Thank you very much, Ephraim, for the kind words. And it's interesting being on this side of the podium for once. I spent a lot of time on that side. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah, great. So my name is Stefan Merskog. I'm with Morgan Solar. Just a few quick words about the company. Morgan Solar was started in 2007 by John Paul Morgan, who is also alum of U of T, both Yale Engineering and Physics departments. Just a little bit of background on the motivation behind the company is the founder, John Paul Morgan, after doing his degrees, worked for some time in industry in JDS Uniphase. He went and did Doctors Without Borders, spent some time in Africa, and what he saw that held things back in Africa was just a lack of available electricity. Just for lack of electricity, people were walking 10 miles a day to get to pick up water. Whereas they could put in a few pumps with just a couple of solar panels. So he wanted to find a way to bring cheaper electricity to regions that did not have reliable electrical power. So he started up the company, and what he knew was optics. He knew he wasn't going to go make a brand new cell, but he knew optics very well. So he used his optics knowledge to create an optical concentrator to focus light onto a very small semiconductor cell to create electricity from sunlight using much, much less semiconductor than you would see on a standard silicon module. And of course, our solution is all based in optics from his background, my background, and a few other people in the company. So quick outline for this talk. I'm going to spend a few slides talking about what the solar resource is, a little bit in the solar energy industry, photovoltaic devices, introduction of concentrated photovoltaics, how that's different from the ubiquitous silicon modules that are out there. Specifically talk about Morgan Solar's Sun Simba, the name for our concentrator, and then discuss just a few of the challenges that trying to build a device that operates at 1,000 suns concentration. So very few words in this talk. I'll mostly be pointing at things. So you're not going to see a lot of basic science, but there's a lot of research that had to go into making these things work. So solar resource. To begin with the sun. From the sun's output of light toward the Earth, at the edge of the Earth's atmosphere, there is 1366 watts per square meter of the surface. So a little over a kilowatt for every square meter. By the time it gets through the atmosphere, that 1.3 kilowatts is reduced to about 1,000 watts or one kilowatt. In sunny conditions, if it's overcast, so you're down to 100 watts, 200 watts per square meter. But the energy incident on the Earth, you take this 1366, multiply it by the cross-sectional area of the Earth, you have 173 petawatts of power incident. Now, peta is 10 to the 15, so you have 173 times 10 to the 15 watts, this figure down here, or this is about 86 million Niagara Falls power generation plants. So the Niagara Falls plant generates 2 gigawatts at its peak output, so you need 86 million of these to equal the amount of energy that's incident on the Earth from the sun. Just a quick map of how much sunlight there is, incident, or what the available sunlight is in different locations of the Earth. So the available sunlight is the sunlight that reaches the ground. So if you're in a region which is very cloudy, of course, you have less sunlight that's available. If you're in the equatorial belt, you get a lot of sun. So looking at North America specifically, we are in this kind of light blue region here. This is a false color plot going from about we're at basically about 175 watts per meter squared on average, averaging over 24 hours. And the Southern California is about twice as much sunlight available as we have here. Chile, even higher. But Africa, like the Middle East region and China, and Australia have a huge amount of solar resource. And many of these regions really are desperate for new sources of energy, reliable, portable sources of energy that don't require large infrastructure for, like, for example, a large grid to support it. Now, we're not in the best region here in Ontario. However, that doesn't mean we can't do very well. Mostly Europe is very comparable to us. Germany has even a little bit less sunlight than we do, but they are the world leader right now in terms of their installed solar capacity. In fact, a few points last year, Germany was able to produce over 50% of their required energy needs strictly through their solar, through all their installed solar capacity. So I'm going to take you some very sloppy math right now. You have Toronto has about, every square meter sees about 1.3 kilowatt hours per year. Sorry, 1,300 kilowatt hours per year, or about 3.6 kilowatt hours per day. Now, standard silicon module is about 15% efficient. So this means in a day, you should be able to make about 600 watt hours per square meter. One square meter of solar panel at 15% efficiency would be a 150-watt panel. This costs you around 70. In volume, you can get these panels for about 70 cents a watt. So you're going to spend about $100 on a 150-watt panel. This creates about 219 kilowatt hours per year. At a 10 cent per kilowatt hour rate, which is what we pay for electricity for residential, this produces about $22 of income a year. So your payback period is 4.6 years. Well, this is very, I'm washing a lot of things under the table here. A solar panel sitting out by itself will, of course, not do anything. You need infrastructure. You need an inverter, you need cabling, you need to tie into your existing grid. And this 70 cents a watt will very quickly balloon up to about $3 a watt. So now you're kind of breaking even. You're on the order of 20 years for a payback time, except that Ontario has a very aggressive feed-in tariff where they pay you five times more for electricity that you produce than the electricity that you consume. So with Ontario paying you 50 cents a kilowatt hour, you're actually producing $100 a year, and your payback is back down to about 4 years. If you look at just the roof of the physics building, according to Google Earth, this is about 26 and a half meters by 26 and a half meters. This is just a tower. You could put about 104 kilowatts worth of panel up on the roof, generating 152 megawatt hours of electricity for $15,000 income, or at the residential rate, or $75,000 if you're at the with the feed-in tariff. So solar industry has been growing very rapidly. In 2000, there was just over a gigawatt installed. Right now, at 2012, there's 102 gigawatts. Sorry, at the end of 2012, there were 102 gigawatts of installed solar worldwide. And it was 31 gigawatts installed. So a third of that capacity was installed just in 2012. And that has, it kind of plateaued for another year after this, but many countries slowed down, but China alone installed more than 30 gigawatts in the past year. So China's moving very aggressively to install a lot of solar. So right now, to get solar industry moving, a lot of countries are offering incentives. But really, what you want to do is you want to be below, at or better than grid parity. So grid parity is the point at which you can create a solar farm and you can get energy out of it for the exact same price as you would pay to the grid. So on this plot here, we have the cost of electricity in dollars per kilowatt hour. A horizontal plot is the solar resource in any given region. Each circle here is a country where the size of the circle is proportional to the size of the market. And in 2012, we have this line here. This is the levelized cost of energy. This line is saying that based on the cost of installing a solar farm, in every one of these countries, you can install a solar farm and get electricity cheaper than you can buy it off the grid. By 2015, the prediction is that we'd now start to include the United Kingdom or Japan, South Korea, Brazil, two other countries. And as the cost of panels and the cost of all the associated infrastructure gets cheaper, you move these curves move further and further down toward this point here. Likewise, of course, inflation, electricity is getting more and more expensive. So this curve kind of moves down rapidly. Canada enjoys a very low cost of energy. Most other places do not. So now a little bit moving away from industry, talk about kind of the ubiquitous solution out there, which is silicon modules. The way a silicon module is manufactured is you get you have a melt of silicon, so essentially you start with silica, sand, melt it down in a furnace, and you get some polysilicon feedstock, further melt that down, and you can draw an ingot of silicon out of just a molten pool, and this can be very high purity. You can have monocrystalline ingots. So these ingots that are formed, you then dice it down to 250 microns in thickness, put it through a few chambers to treat it, to introduce dopants to the material, to apply metallization so you can extract electricity. And then you get a wafer here, which is about 15 centimeters across, can produce about 8 amps at around 0.5, 0.6 volts. So you get about 4 watts here. And then you get about 60 of these, put them into a module, and you have a 240, 250-watt module. You can get higher efficiencies, but you are no longer paying this 70 cents an hour rate, 70 cents per watt rate. You're paying a large premium for higher efficiency. So very few words about the photovoltaic effect. So the photovoltaic effect, you have your wafer of silicon. It is P-type. Typically, the bulk of the wafer is P-type. You have an n-type doped region at the very top. Photons come from the sun into the silicon, creates an electron hole pair. The electron moves up under an induced field. It's collected by the metallic contacts, going through the wires, doing some work at a light bulb, computer, motor, and then comes back into the silicon, recombining with one of the holes to create your electric circuit. If you want to go a little deeper, you can look at an energy band diagram. You have a P and N type silicon. You bring them together, you create this PN junction, where you have a Fermi level, which is flat when you're at equilibrium. Photons come in, creates an electron-hole pair. Electron typically will have far more energy than you need, but very quickly thermalizes down to the conduction band. Hole thermalizes to the valence band. The electron, being heavy, falls down the potential hill here, and travels to this metal contact and exits. Holes, being very light, float, and they move up and come out to this other metal contact. So you have your flow of electrons around your circuit. And from this, as a function of voltage or current, you can get a current voltage plot. So this point here tells you the maximum current you can extract from this module. There's the open circuit voltage, the maximum voltage you can extract. Multiply voltage current to get your power curve. And ideally, you want to operate at this max power point. So you can't just take your solar panel, throw it on 20 device. If you have the wrong load impedance, you're going to do a very poor job of extracting energy. So silicon has a band gap of 1.1 electron volts. What this means is you can absorb any photon with energy greater than 1.1 electron volt, but not lower than that band gap energy. So this black curve is the spectrum of the sun. And this red curve is the energy extracted from that light. So if you have a photon at 1,100 nanometers, basically 1.1 electron volts, that photon turns into one electron. And if you ignore almost all the details of semiconductor physics, it comes out at the band gap energy of 1.1 electron volts. However, you take a blue photon around 400 nanometers, which has 3 electron volts of energy. When it gets absorbed, it doesn't give you 3 electron or 3 volts output. It gives you, it very rapidly thermalizes down to the band gap, and you again get 1.1 volts out. So you're actually up, these 400 nanometer photons are converted with one-third the efficiency of a like 1100 nanometer photon. And so this, the combination, basically the area under this curve versus the area under the spectral curve is your efficiency of your cell. Now, as I said, this ignores a bunch of semiconductor physics, which tells you that your voltage output is not equal to your band gap. Silicon typically has a voltage of 0.6 volts. So you would then further reduce this by the voltage differential. But from this this viewpoint, you have a, you can find that there's a limit to the efficiency of 32%. You can, of course, use some other materials. Silicon is the most commonly used material for photovoltaics, but there are other choices. CAD telluride is used to create very thin films. So instead of having a 250 micron thick wafer, you might have a couple microns of cadmium telluride film. These can be very high efficiency, quite close to the, or even sometimes above the efficiency of silicon. Manufacture can be very different. There's amorphous silicon, SIGS, which is copper, indium, gallium, selenide. It's a newer material that's being studied and in the process of commercialization. And then there are a variety of organic materials which you can use to make solar cells and nanocrystalline-based materials to create solar cells. Now, if you use one of this, if we added some imaginary material which had a band gap of 2 volts, then we see that we can very efficiently use the photons in the blue end of the spectrum up to green, but you don't have any photon collection here, so you end up with a higher voltage output but a lower current. You're collecting fewer photons. This is a standard plot that goes up in almost every photovoltaic talk. This is the record cell efficiencies since 1975. All the blue points are varieties of silicon cells. And the record on here the record efficiency here is 27.6 for silicon. The green points are thin films, which include the SIGs, CAD telluride. They're getting 22-23%. A variety of organic disensitized cells, quantum dots, and they are, the best one of these is 16%. Now, the technology we use is none of these. We use what's called a multi-junction cell, which is, as it sounds, 3 different solar cells stacked one above the other to make more efficient use of the spectrum. And when you, under concentration, these have reached as high as 44.4%. A decade ago, they were around 34%. So these cells are increasing about 1% per year in efficiency. So that leads into concentrated photovoltaics. So as I briefly mentioned before, concentrated photovoltaics is the idea of taking an inexpensive optical system to collect light over a large area, focus it onto a very small but very efficient solar cell, and use much, much less semiconductor material. Now, these solar cells that we use are about 40% efficient. The lab record is 44.4. The commercial production does hit 42%, though. CPV will typically operate at a concentrations of about 500 suns to 1,000 suns. But it's a lot more engineering. We have silicon modules that work very well. We know how to build them to be reliable. So why would you go looking for another technology? Well, the only reason is cheaper electrons. When you go and build a solar farm, the only question that the purchaser or the bank who's financing it wants to know is, how much are we paying per electron with this system versus some other system? And beyond that, what is the technology risk? You can have a great new technology, but if it has a lot of risks, no one wants to lose all their money on something that might fail. So these cells are, I'm showing a little wafer here. These cells are typically very small, so if you have an optic which is around 20 centimeters across, the cell might be only 5 or 6 millimeters in size. So on a wafer, you can get hundreds or thousands of cells, depending on the size requirement. Now, these cells are very different from silicon. Silicon cells are grown in a, you're pulling an ingot out of a crucible. Here, these are grown through metalloorganic chemical vapor deposition, which means these are grown epitaxially layer by layer. You begin with a perfect substrate. In this case, you begin with a germanium substrate, and they flow chemicals which contain the precursors. So at one point, they might flow gallium and arsenide-based gases over them, and these the gallium and arsenide atoms will self-assemble into a perfect crystal. So you grow this crystal with the germanium, gallium arsenide, and indium gallium phosphide, and you end up with a cell that's about 40% efficient. This single wafer at 1,000 times concentration can produce about 6 kilowatts. So first question, you have a wafer that's 40% efficient. Why don't you just go start building modules out of these 40% efficient cells? Well, it turns out that this wafer is thousands and thousands of dollars, around $30,000 to make this wafer. $30,000 per square meter of wafer, whereas silicon is $100 per square meter. So there's a big, big price difference. The only way to make economical use of these 40% efficient cells is to use a concentrator. Use something very inexpensive and a commodity material to do your focusing of light. So the few different types of CPV. The most common type is a Fresnel lens, where sunlight hits the Fresnel lens. The Fresnel lens focuses that light onto a small cell. And you need a focal depth, which is generally at least the size of your optic. So if this is 20 centimeters, you want 20 centimeters or more to do your focusing. Parabolic mirror is another option, where all the light that hits this parabolic mirror gets focused to a central point here. Again, this whole device has a fair bit of depth. A cassegrain optic, which is essentially a telescope optic, where you have a reflective surface which reflects light off this curve. This light hits a secondary mirror here, and that focuses the light down onto a cell. Or you can have a central collector, which is basically a very large dish, looks like a satellite dish covered in mirrors. And all the light incident on the mirrors is reflected to a central point and collected as energy here. But every one of these options has a lot of depth to it. So that depth has consequences. One is it's an air cavity. You need to somehow handle that air cavity. When you're concentrating 1,000 times, a cell can go from 0 degrees if it's just been nighttime in the desert up to 60, 70, 80 Celsius very rapidly, and the whole air cavity will change over time from 0 to 80, so the cavity can deform. The cavity deforms, your optics are deforming, and you're losing focus on your cell. So I move from there into our Morgan Solar's device in a second, but before that, operating at high concentration has a number of consequences. If you take light and put it through a lens, focus it onto a cell, well, if you're normal to that light, you can do an excellent job. You get a nice, clean focal point on your cell. If, however, you're a little bit off axis, then that light can now start to miss the cell. And if it's missing the cell, you're, of course, not generating energy. In CPV, the angular acceptance, the range over which you have nearly full power production, is 1 degree or less. A lot of systems are around half a degree angular acceptance, a lot of them around 1 degree. But the sun moves through the sky at about 1 degree every 4 minutes, so it's not going to be sufficient to put out your module, and produce energy for 4 minutes and wait till the next day. So you need to take your module and put it onto a tracking system. We need to have a dual-axis tracking to follow the sun throughout the day. Generally, you would have azimuth to do like a east-west, and then elevation change to follow the sun as it rises and falls in the sky. Now, a consequence of having this narrow acceptance angle is you can only use the beam portion of radiation that's coming from the sun. So if you look up in the sky, which I don't recommend, at the sun, which I don't recommend, the bright disk that you see is about 0.27 degrees in angle that's subtended. Everything else, the rest of the sky you see is diffuse light. So it's light that comes from the sun, gets scattered by molecules, particles in the air, and then comes to you from some other angle far from the sun. But none of that radiation can be collected by a CPV device. So on a clear day, diffuse radiation might make up 20% of the energy. On an overcast day, it can make up 100%, obviously, in which case a CPV device doesn't actually generate anything for you. There's a few examples of some CPV systems. There's Aminex, to use a Fresnel lens design. You can see the scale of the of their modules and their tracking system relative to this car. Suncor, these are kind of roughly half the size of a bathtub and around the depth of a bathtub each. This is Solar Systems, an Australian company that using the central collector style, where the light incident on these mirrors gets focused to the collector here, and Soul Focus, which uses a Cassegrain style optic. So a little bit of the physics of concentrated photovoltaics. The multi-junction cells, which I explained briefly, it's effectively three cells grown one above the other. You have to, at this 1,000 times concentration, you have to worry about all your thermal effects, and there's a couple of optical losses that you cannot avoid as well. So a multi-junction cell. The multi-junction cell basically takes the incident sunlight, and you have three different solar cells, each with different band gaps. So the upper cell has a band gap of around 1.9 electron volts. It's basically absorbing from the edge of blue, a little bit into the UV, up to into the green. The middle cell is a band gap of around 1.4. This is gallium arsenide. Sorry, top cell is indium gallium phosphide. The middle gallium arsenide cell collects from far green, or actually in the red, to the near infrared at about 8. So it's collecting from 660 to 880 nanometers. The bottom cell is made of germanium with a band gap around 0.6. So this is collecting the leftover light from 880 nanometers up to about 1700 nanometers. The entire stack here of materials is grown epitaxially, and this is a compressed list. There's actually around 30 different layers of material grown in making one of these cells. Now, you can't just take a bunch of these cells and stack them one on top of the other, because you end up with a large problem. Each cell is a p-n junction. So we have a p-n junction, p-n junction, p-n junction. In between, I would have a p-n junction of the opposite polarity. So I'd have a diode which fights against the effect I'm trying to, fights against the photovoltaic effect and will prevent me from getting any energy out. So they have to build in a tunnel junction diode in between. And what the tunnel junction diode does is it lets an electron, so if you, for example, if a photon comes in here, creates an electron hole pair right in this region here where the cell is, that electron falls down, ends up in this region here, and it can, the conduction band here has the exact same energy as the valence band on this side. So the electron can actually tunnel through this barrier, ends up in the valence band, where it can now absorb another photon to then exit this side of the cell. So you end up gaining the voltage from both cells for that electron. So when you have these three cells stacked one across one above the other with the 1.9, 1.4, and 0.6 electron volts, you can actually get electrons out at about 3.2 electron volts of potential. But now you do need three photons for every one electron that comes out. So silicon versus multi-junction. What makes this really more efficient than silicon? Well, it's just better utilization of the solar spectrum. For silicon, as I showed you before, there's this curve, and the area under the curve is effectively the efficiency of the silicon. The multi-junction cell makes much better use. So this blue photon, which had 3 electron volts, which gets thermalized down to one electron volt in silicon, well, it gets thermalized down to 1.9 in the indium gallium phosphide. Likewise, the band between 660 and 680 all gets thermalized to the 1.4 electron volts, and all these photons get thermalized to the 0.6. But your efficiency is proportional to the area under the curve. So you have much more area under this curve than you do under the silicon's curve. So thermal management. Focusing sunlight by 1,000 times has some undesirable effects. It deposits a lot of heat. I'm sure everybody here has at some point played with magnifying glass outside, burning paper, wood, or done some worse things shouldn't mention. But as you've all seen, you damage materials very, very rapidly. If you look at a silicon cell, the incident light on here is 100 milliwatts per centimeter squared. Now, a module, though, does not take a lot of time before a module put outside gets up to 50, 60 Celsius. And this is silicon, where it's just at one sun. This little tiny multi-junction cell is at 100 watts per centimeter squared. It's 1,000 times more intense. So you've got to work very hard to get all your heat out of the cell. So you need very good heat sinking and dissipation of that heat. Sorry, my little inset here is the Archimedes burning an invading fleet with mirrors. MIT, a group of MIT students set out to disprove that it could be done, and yet they ended up proving it. So cell response to heat. The cell will get very hot under concentration or even without concentration. As the cell heats up, the lattice expands due to its coefficient of thermal expansion. As you have your lattice gets larger, your wave functions get larger or get longer. It means you have a lower energy wave function and your band gap decreases. Decreasing your band gap decreases the voltage out of the cell. So we need to do everything we can to keep these cells as cool as possible. And so some optical losses. Fresnel reflection, you can't avoid that. Well, you can through a lot of effort, but it's not economical. If you have light entering from a material with one index of refraction to another index of refraction, you get a Fresnel reflection. So with glass or our plastics that we use with an index of 1.5, you get a 4% reflection of this interface, 4% reflection off that interface, and further down you'll have some more optics and a cell to go into, and you get further reflections. In the end, you have a minimum of 12% reflection due to 12% loss from Fresnel reflections. Absorption: every material absorbs light at some level. Glass can be very transmissive, but a lot of glass that you look at, even some high-tech glasses, have a little bit of tint in them. They might be absorbing a little bit of blue or a little bit of green. The polymers we use are crystal clear in the visible. However, in the infrared, this region, you've got some absorption bands. So by the time you go through 10 centimeters of polymer, you've created some holes in your spectrum. Now, thankfully, these holes happen to line up with water absorption bands in the atmosphere. So you only get hit once. You don't get a double impact from these from the absorption in polymer. And just a manufacturing detail is you have draft losses. When you have you're creating tools to create these optical components, you can't have a completely vertical face. If you have vertical faces, your part gets stuck. You inject hot material into a mold. It takes the shape of the mold, cools down, and it wants to compress. That means it's pushing against these matching facets in the mold, and you cannot pull the part out of the mold. So you actually need an angle on these facets in order to pull the part out. So any light that is incident above that facet is lost. It does not get coupled to the cell. And likewise, you have edges of your optics which are not active because you need to attach to a box, your container for a lot, most CPV, or you're bonding two different materials together. a little bit now into Morgan Solar and how we do things differently. So this Fresnel lens is this kind of approach that almost all CPV companies use. What we've done is develop a different kind of lens. We have a lens which is very, very flat. It's a low profile, aspect ratio of 20 to 1, and our cell is actually located on the bottom of the lens. So I like to call it a zero focal length lens. It's not really true. What we've actually done is create a waveguide. We couple light into a waveguide. So light enters, it's turned laterally into the waveguide, and then we turn it again onto the cell. And this is a picture of one of our devices. This is 20 centimeters across, and it's less than a centimeter thick. And that would be mounted directly onto the heatsink, and the cell is mounted in the middle. It's right into the middle. The cell is 5.5 millimeters in size, and the optic is 200 millimeters across. So the geometric concentration, the ratio of the area of the collector to the area of the cell is about 1,400. And after all the optical losses, we have about a factor of 1,000 incident on the cell. So here's a little bit of the evolution of the module. This is one of the very first prototypes. So this is a piece of acrylic that has been cut to our specification. So light is incident on the normal to the top face. We have these air cavities here. And so what happens is light is incident, hits this air cavity, and at this point, you go in from a high index to a low index, and you undergo total internal reflection. So the light then reflects in this direction. We have a little aperture here, so light goes through the aperture and starts to undergo TIR throughout this light guide. And this is just it in action. We have a green laser pointer just entering the one facet, and you can see its path through the waveguide. And this was far from a perfect optical surface, so you see it gets a couple of bounces where you can see where the beam was, but it gets scattered around pretty quickly. But this is proof of principle, and it showed us that this can work. We went to our next prototype with a target concentration of 300. These were little kind of pie-shaped sections where the cell would sit vertically on the end, and we made a little mini module. Didn't work so well. We had, and here we were a bit too aggressive, and we were not. Our feature size was too small, and the molding was not able to reproduce all of our features accurately. Prototype 5. This was a diamond turn prototype. So what this means is instead of creating a mold, which is a mirror image of your part, and then injecting plastic into it, which is necessary for commercial production, but it's a imperfect way of reproducing a structure. This device was diamond turned, so you put a chunk of acrylic on a lathe and you turn it very, very accurately. This had a concentration of 100 suns, and we were able to achieve that concentration. We sent one down to NREL in the U.S., National Renewable Energy Labs, and melted it in 2 days. It was not really designed to stay on sun. This had a plastic center, so the plastic was not able to handle all the heat that was delivered at the cell. And so the design was never to have plastic in the middle. We do transition to glass right before the cell. This is a lesson in how fast we could damage it, though, if we were trying. So the prototype 8, this is the pre-production to our first pilot line. This is about 20 centimeters across. We have a little ray trace here. And this was mounted in an aluminum frame. And this is a little picture of the cell underneath. Again, diamond turned. And we were eventually able to get about 90% of our target efficiency out of it. But we ran into a few snags, which I'll tell you about in a second. That design led to Gen 2. This is a sample module that we had up at our test site here in Toronto. You can see it's on a two-axis tracker. But we have these 20 centimeter by 20 centimeter squares. The rows are offset from one another for airflow. Again, making these optics is a challenge. We had some molding issues, so things didn't quite align quite correctly. So we take all of our learning and move into another generation. This is Gen 3, which we've deployed in the California desert. This is a small portion of our array down there at a test site. Now, if you could see closely, as you saw in an earlier image, each of these is hexagonal. Turns out, when you do all your optics, the corners are a bad idea. While very easy to build, kind of seems the thing you want to go for right away. Boxes are square or rectangular. Why not have 90-degree corners? Well, the light entering at the very edge, at the corners, has the farthest path to travel to get to the cell. And that means it has the worst angular acceptance. So that part of the optic has the worst angular acceptance. So it has the most sensitivity to your alignment, contributes the least. So the best shape is a circle. However, circles don't tile nicely. Hexagons tile nicely. So we went with hexagons for this generation. So we've deployed these down in California at our site here in Toronto, and University of Ottawa has a small site of ours as well. These have been monitored for about two years now at University of Ottawa and at our site. And we got up to around 90% of our target design after about 2 years of work. It's a lot of iteration of changing the mold. I mean, part of the problem is that you have a target design for your polymer. So you create a mold base for your polymer. However, the plastic shrinks about 1.5% from what your mold is to when it comes out and cools down completely. You get a 1.5% change in size, which means your tolerances would be completely off. So you got to predict how is it going to change from manufacturing from the mold into the final product. You always get this wrong, so you go back and you do a recut, play with your process parameters to try to get it to fit exactly the shape and size you want. That's a few of the challenges. One is material stability. This is going to operate at 1,000 suns, so you need to make sure that all of your optics, this includes polymers, silicones, and glass, are all going to survive 1,000 suns concentration. You have a bunch of non-optical materials, whether they're ceramics, copper, aluminum. Everything's got to survive, and you need adhesives. The whole thing's got to be held together somehow, and few adhesives survive the punishment that they'll go through in a 20 years of being in desert, never mind putting them in a concentrated device. Then there's thermal performance and stability, operation under high flux, problems with thermal expansion and cell reliability, optics manufacturer, they're just hard. We run into all sorts of issues in trying to make optics. So optical reliability, the performance of your CPV device depends on the optical transmission of every optical component in this path. So you have to be very careful with your selection. You need a material that has very high optical clarity in the visible and the IR. If you're using polymer, you have to give up a little bit in the IR. So that is going to be a performance hit, but our bet is that we can produce these for cheaper than silicon, so we can take a little bit of a performance hit and still be far more efficient than silicon. You need very good reliability. The color cannot change. You put a plastics outside, a lot of run-of-the-mill plastics are just going to turn yellow in a year's time, never mind 20 years' time. So selection, and you take steps to prevent damage. This little cartoon shows basically we're aggregating light as we travel down our waveguide. So we have sunlight comes into this facet here, enters the waveguide, travels down to the edge. This is one sun entering. This is a comparable size here, so it's about one sun at this exit facet. Then the next facet concentrates light, and so on and so on. And at the end, at the exit of our acrylic, we have 35 times solar intensity, at which point we move into glass. But this plastic does need to survive the 35 suns. So a little test bed we set up outdoors. What we have, something did not work right here, but anyways. This is our little test bed. Essentially, this is a bunch of optical, little couple of tubes containing optics to focus sunlight onto little test plaques of polymer, our glasses, our silicones, adhesives, and we look at the change in transmission over time. So we put a few samples out here under our optics, making sure that our optics transmit UV, because a lot of materials will not transmit UV, and UV is what's responsible for most of your damage. We do periodic measurements of the spectral transmission, and over 9 months, we can really not see any transmission to within our resolution, changes in transmission to the resolution limits of our spectrometers. So great, we're done. Well, this is Toronto. Not the most reliable resource for, not the best location for the sun, for sunlight, and it's not mimicking a desert environment in any way. And we need to prove 25 years of reliability. So we do some highly accelerated lifetime testing indoors. We use a couple of xenon lamps, which have a spectrum which is very, very close to the sun spectrum, including the UV component. We couple the light through a bunch of fibers into these test platforms, which is basically just a very tightly focusing lens, and we're focusing up to about 400 suns on our various samples. At 400 suns in 8 hours, you basically do the equivalent of 1 year's dose of sunlight, and over a 24-hour period, you're basically doing 3 years' exposure. So very rapidly, you can build up a lot of data for how it performs over time. So we take one of our materials and just throw everything at it, UV light, invisible light, and very quickly it starts to degrade. At 60 years, we're getting about 20% transmission in the blue. This thing is very yellow at this point. Maybe 30, 40% in the green, but this would totally kill the device. At 20 years, though, which is right around this region here, we've lost a lot of performance. By keeping the same material, which is really a very high optical clarity, which we need for the light guide to transmit our light, we put another material in front of it, which has a UV filter in it. Again, it's another polymer, but it's stabilized. It blocks UV light so that UV light cannot be concentrated within the waveguide. And after the equivalent of 70 years of outdoor exposure, we cannot measure a change in transmission. So we have, at this point now, we've got a good candidate material for concentrating light in polymer. We likewise measure our glasses. A lot of glasses will turn gray if they're in sunlight for too long due to iron ions. Again, you go through your process. There's a lot more information about glass under sunlight than there is about polymers, so it's not as difficult to process. So I mentioned we did some testing of this one prototype. So this prototype was sent to the National Renewable Energy Lab, the who's who, basically, of photovoltaics. NREL is, they're the ones that do official testing of products, tells you what your official efficiency is. And they do a lot of research. So they took this device, put it on sun for a while, and then gave us some results with a bit of a shock. In this plot here, it shows the temperature sensitivity of the device. So the output power is a function of temperature. And what they saw is that we're losing 2% performance per Celsius at this per Celsius increase in temperature. The cell should only have a 0.15% change in performance per Celsius. So we're seeing 12 times more change than we expect. So we were stumped for a while. What went wrong? Well, we did our optical design, very careful to match all of our coefficients of thermal expansion. So basically, as a polymer gets hot, it expands a little bit, but there's two different polymer pieces. They expand together. Everything's great, but we didn't account for this aluminum frame. And this was effectively a press fit into the aluminum. So you do a thermal model, calculate how much power hits the cell, how much power is hitting the plastic and the aluminum, determine what temperature everything hits. So the cell here was hitting 45 degrees when the ambient temperature was 20. So we got a 25 degree temperature differential. in the from the cell out to the edge. And so you do some more thermomechanical modeling, and you realize that we've got a problem. The optics, which were a press fit into the aluminum to keep everything clean, is constrained. The optics are not allowed to expand past the aluminum. The aluminum expanded by 80 microns with this temperature change. The optics wanted to expand 280. They can't expand laterally, so they flex. They bow up to take up that extra 200 microns. And they ended up bowing by about 400 microns vertically. The lower optical component had a flexure of about 180 microns. So we basically opened a gap of 200 microns in the center of the optic. And this caused light to miss the apertures to focus it from the upper optic into the waveguide. So we were no longer coupling light to the cell. And at low temperatures, of course, it was not this drastic, but as you get hotter and hotter, your deflection gets larger and larger. So just to be clear, the deformations here have been magnified by a factor of 80, so they're easy to see. They did not look like this in the field. again, optics are difficult. We are working with one of the top optics manufacturers in Europe. This is a group that would produce precision optics for telescopes, satellite-mounted telescopes. They made components for detectors for CERN, which had sub-nanometer accuracy requirements. It seemed like they're the best people to work with to produce the molds for our optics. However, we'd produce optics, and we see you hold it at some angle to light, and you see diffraction. You get this rainbow of light coming back at you, not quite as bad as a CD player, as when you look at a CD or DVD, but it's there. Now, what this means, when you see this, that means there's light escaping from the waveguide. In particular, blue light is being the worst affected, and then green. And we're throwing away 30% of our light. So you start digging into it. We did some scanning electron microscopy in the medical sciences building, and looking at the edge of some of the polymer surfaces, and we see this periodic structure. And we measure it. It's got a period of about 1,400 nanometers, depth of 250 nanometers. This is an excellent diffraction grading. And it matches perfectly the intensity of diffraction that we're observing. So we go back to our manufacturers. We're asking, what's going on? How are we possibly getting these features? Well, they come back to us. It's impossible. They're using a diamond to cut their tools. And the diamond has a radius of curvature of about 80 microns. But we're seeing a 1.4 micron spacing here, and the curvature is far under 80 microns. Well, after examining the diamond used to do the cutting, they found a burr on the edge of the diamond, and that burr was doing the cutting on some of our surfaces. So it took a while. There's a number of iterations, of course, trying to figure out what's going on, blaming the machines or the programming, but in the end, it was a burr. So cell reliability as well. These cells are under very high stress. They'll go from 0 Celsius to 60 Celsius in a second. If you go from a kind of cold start in the morning and then suddenly blast it with sunlight. Now, to be clear, they have the whole structure would hit 60 Celsius, around 60 Celsius at thermal equilibrium. But the very first thing that happens is that the epitaxial layers, the cell, which is only a couple microns thick, that heats up first. Transfers energy into the substrate before and then into the heat sink eventually. But initially, you've got a very hot cell sitting on some other cold materials. And that cell expands. So if the cell expands and the material it sits on top of does not expand, that means the cell wants to flex. Or it's under a lot of stress and strain, and it will develop fractures. As soon as a cell starts to fracture, it drops efficiency, and it is once one fracture starts, that repeated cycles cause that fracture to grow and grow until it just destroys the cell. So when you're engineering the cell, you've got to be very careful. You need a material that has the same coefficient of thermal expansion as the cell so that you don't put the cell under stress or strain. So you find some ceramics. It turns out that aluminum oxide is an excellent match to the cell for coefficient of thermal expansion. Metals, no metals are. However, you can't attach a cell directly to the ceramic. So you put a very, very thin copper foil and you bond that onto the ceramic. So you have a cell now soldered down to the copper foil on top of the ceramic. Great, go ahead, you throw that outside and you start breaking things. What happens now is that this, if you have just a single layer of copper on the one side, that copper is expanding more than the ceramic, so it causes the whole ceramic to bow down, cracking the cell. So you throw down another layer of copper on the bottom so that the top, the copper on top and the copper of bottom are both pushing on the ceramic equally. And now the ceramic does not flex, the cell does not flex, and you can get a reliable bond between a reliable carrier for your cell. So this ceramic is a necessary component of this whole device. Then this is attached through solder or epoxy onto your heatsink. Due to the concentration levels you operate at, you have a lot of heat going through this bond. If you have a small void equal to about 3% of the area of the cell in that copper or epoxy, you'll get a runaway thermal process where the corner of the cell that has a void, that corner gets hot. The hot corner has a lower voltage, so all the electrons want to flow to that corner. As you have more and more current flow all going through that corner, that corner gets hotter and hotter very rapidly, and then you get very rapid cell failure. So you have to make sure in your process that your bond between the cell and the heatsink is excellent. You cannot afford any kind of void. So just in review, talk a little bit about solar resource and the energy industry, a little bit of photovoltaic devices, constrained photovoltaics, and our Morgan Solar Sun Simba and the challenges of 1,000 suns. And of course, the only reason to try to do this, to make a constrained photovoltaic device, is we believe we can do it cheaper than silicon. Just to tell you a bit where we are unfortunately not using any of the devices I showed you today. We have moved on to another generation, the previous generation, which is this one here. We started this about 3 years ago when the cost of silicon solar cells was much higher. In a period of a couple years, the cost of silicon had fallen a factor of 6. So the device, which looked great when we first got our investment, no longer looks so good. We couldn't justify trying to build, you know, large quantities of a device which is more expensive now than silicon. So we had to kind of go back and hit the drawing board again. And so we have a new device coming out, same principles, but looks very different. We've changed the size scale dramatically, eliminated our heatsink altogether, although I know I said that was a bad thing. It can be done with very good thermal management. And so we've only built a couple at this point, but we are getting very close to our goal of a 30% efficient module, which is already exceeding the best efficiency this could ever have had. So I know normally you recognize your collaborators. In this case, that means recognizing our investors, Iberdrola, Enbridge, Nipro, Ontario 222, and of course some of our academic partners. We've worked for a long time with the University of Ottawa, the Mars Center here, just across the street here, and University of Ottawa more recently. And we've worked with the University of Toronto as well, so I should have another one up here. And we've got quite a lot of support from the Ontario and federal governments. So that's the end of the talk. Thank you very much, and glad to take